My name is Andrew Gamson, and it is my privilege to welcome you to the Culture Watch podcast, a podcast of Speaking for Him. Thank you so much for listening today. I hope that you will find something to encourage you on your Christian walk, especially as we engage with others on these important issues of culture and news, because the things that go on around us affect us, whether directly or indirectly, and we need to know how to have a biblical response to them. I've been so gratified by the number of people that have been listening to the show. I am so thankful for each and every one of you, and I hope that if there is any feedback that you want to give me, that you will share that with me via email or another contact option that will roll at the end of the show. I would be glad to hear from you. And with that being said, let's jump into news for the week of April 15th. Today we're going to start with a story that accentuates some of the complications that come with America's approach to illegal immigration.
Fox News alert now, an Afghan national with ties to terror is now in custody, according to DHS. This after he was apprehended at our southern border, then released not once but twice into the U.S. Madeline Rivera joins us now. Maddie.
Good morning, Brian. It took about a year before this Afghan migrant was taken back into U.S. custody. But Homeland Security officials say immigration officials did not release him knowing he had terror ties. NBC First reported Mohammed Karwin was initially arrested in March 2023 near San Ysidro, California, after crossing illegally at the southern border. But DHS officials say at the time, Customs and Border Protection could not conclusively prove that Karwin was on the terror watch list. He was referred to immigration at Customs Enforcement and released on ATD or Alternatives to Detention. Then, as our Bill Malugin reports, in February 2024, he was officially added to the FBI terror watch list after new concerning information was developed on him. ICE was notified and ICE arrested him in San Antonio, Texas. NBC reports the database indicates Karwin is a member of HIG, a group responsible for attacks in Afghanistan that killed at least nine American soldiers and civilians from 2013 to 2015. Karwin's court hearing took place 2 weeks ago, and during his appearance, DHS prosecutors allegedly did not tell the federal immigration judge that he was a possible national threat, only arguing that he was a possible flight risk. DHS officials tell Fox they are limited by what they can tell the judge. The judge ordered him released on bond. Again, DHS now says Karwin is back in federal custody, and his next court date is in 2025. Brian.
This is an example of why this issue of illegal immigration comes up so much on this show and why it is so important to have a process in place for allowing people to come into the country. It really doesn't matter all that much that they didn't realize that he was on a terror watch list so much as it matters that he was allowed to illegally enter this country and to be released from any type of criminal consequences for doing so, only to later have it be exposed that he was indeed a threat on the terror watch list. This is why we have an immigration process, and this is why people should not be upset when those in the know want to be vigilant about this. This is why Governor Greg Abbott has constantly stood firmly in opposition to the Biden administration and their lax view on this issue of immigration. The left would like you to believe that everyone that comes over here illegally does so simply because it's too difficult to come over here legally and they just want a fresh start. Well, there are a number of people that come over here with good motives. There are enough people like this who come here with shady motives that we need to constantly be on our guard. And I really am glad that we have Customs Enforcement. Again, this is not a vindictive thing to say. This is a thing that I say and so many others say because we want America to be a place that when people come here, they find safety. they find a place where they can prosper and thrive. I just met a young man from Africa this past week by the name of Sam, who came here because he wants better opportunities here in the United States, which is exactly why someone should come here. And I am so grateful that he is getting the opportunity to live and learn in the greatest country that there is, the United States of America. But the way that we keep it that way is by having strict policies for those who come in. And we cannot apologize for keeping our citizens safe. We know what happened on 9/11, and we know how easy it would be for that process to repeat itself if we do not remain vigilant on the border. We need to make sure that we have a process in place and that we work the process. And as has been said many times before, if the process is not a sufficient process, then maybe we need to revisit it. But we don't revisit it by letting people ignore it. We revisit it by saying, these are the problems in the current policy. How can we fix them? Let's come together as a legislative body and as an executive branch and hammer it out and work until it is done so that we can continue to be a beacon of hope and freedom for those around the world. And the ironic thing to me is that there's so many people who live here who are citizens of this country who claim to hate it, who claim to want America to change its policies to be more like the many countries that people flee to come here. I think that we could all learn from immigrants who've done it the right way if we sit down and learn their stories and ask them, why are you here? And they will tell you, in many cases, how much worse it is for them in their home country and the reason why they have chosen to come to the United States. And I think that if you take an honest listen to stories like that, you will have a renewed appreciation for this wonderful country that you call home. It's very easy to complain about the country we have instead of being grateful for it. And the other thing we need to remember is that the liberty we have is only ours if we fight to keep it. I know I've said this before, but I'm going to repeat it here. Benjamin Franklin was once asked, what have you given us after the Constitutional Congress, after the Declaration of Independence had come out? And he said, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. We must fight to keep the republic. Joe Biden is once again in the news for the potential of some student loan repayments.
All right, this just in, President Biden will approve another $7.4 billion in student loan bailouts today. 277,000 borrowers are going to have their debt canceled as a part of the Biden administration's SAVE plan.
Oh, isn't that convenient? He's also underwater with students and young Americans, so here comes more money. The administration has already cut $153 billion in loan forgiveness. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary KJP says the new move is helping Americans.
The SAVE plan is helping millions of people who earn less than $15 per hour have a monthly payment of $0 and is helping some borrowers get their debts canceled faster. The president will continue fighting to give people more breathing room and using every tool at his disposal to help borrowers.
This comes after the president announced separate plans to relieve student debt for more Americans, which is estimated to cost $84 billion.
He's not forgiving it. He's putting it on other people.
Right.
You know, he's not just erasing it. He's not paying out of his pocket. If he's paying out of his pocket, the Delaware, the fortune that he has assumed, that he's amassed, that's no problem. But he's doing it and putting it into the big pot. Every month we add a trillion to the debt And now we're just arbitrarily deciding that college graduates don't need to pay back their loans.
The question is, how are we going to pay for this? We're already in debt. Mortgage rates, look at those. They were January 2022, 3.2%. Remember those days? Now it's almost 7%. Double. Wall Street Journal did an article about this, talking about how under Trump, prices were stable. And prices didn't rise significantly until Biden's first year in office. They talk about three different individuals. One couple moved into their three-bedroom rental with their three children in 2021. Their plan was only to stay for a year. They determined they still can't afford to buy. Right. Then her sister, who's a mother of three, lives down the street. She's stuck in her home because the cost has deterred them from buying a larger home. And then Emily Farrell, they talked to, had to withdraw an offer on her house in Colorado last week because the final rate from her lender, right, she thought was going to be 7.5%. It ended up being 8.9%. That's $1,000 more a month, and she can't afford it.
It's killing a lot of people. And here's the thing. It's all because of inflation. And we saw it starting with Joe Biden. Inflation was like 1.9%, I think, when he took office. And then because Congress flooded the entire world with so much free money, prices went through the roof. Inflation approached 10%. Just take a look at the prices comparing when Joe Biden took office as they are right now. And as you can see, the number under the each of these items is the number to pay attention to. Butter is up 23%. Flour is up about 25%. Chicken is up 25%. Bread is up 30%. And a dozen eggs is up 104%.
That's how much more money you have to make to afford your items, right, that you were buying.
Okay, first of all, I'm not even sure that the president can constitutionally do this. We've been down this road before where Biden has tried to give people student loan relief or forgiveness, and he's been told by the courts that he cannot do that. I anticipate a similar battle this time. I don't think he's going to get away with this because he doesn't really have a good leg to stand on. We have a legislative process to flush these things out, and he's choosing to be very arbitrary about it, and he's trying to appear as a savior to the college students. The problem here is that the government has caused a lot of the problem. When government took over student loans, they skyrocketed. And the fact of the matter is that unless we shut off the spigot where these loans are coming from, we're not solving anything by forgiving current loans. If you forgive loans for people that have already been to college, and then you turn around and offer the same loan to the graduates of 2024 or the graduates of 2025, you have solved nothing. So I think the greater problem here is that we need to let people know that there are more solutions for work and education than just going to a four-year university. First of all, there are trade schools. Second of all, there are two-year colleges to get your feet wet, to know what you want to do, so that when you do get a degree, it's practical for you. And third of all, when I was in school, I did not take a full load of classes every semester. But one thing that was true of me was that I was able to financially pay for the classes that I did take. Now, I understand that it was almost 20 years ago that I was in college and things are different now, but I ask why. Why is college so expensive? And if the government really wants to help people like they say they do, that is the investigation that needs to take place. They need to ask themselves, why has college education become so expensive? And the bottom line is that whenever you give someone a quote-unquote better way to pay, i.e. a student loan or a mortgage, you are actually asking for the price to go up. Because now it's no longer, I can't go to your program because it's $20,000 a year. Now it's simply, I just need to get a loan for $20,000 a year and I will be okay. But what happens is people have a hard time getting jobs that are commensurate with allowing them to pay off their student loans in a timely manner. The fact of the matter is that I was able to pay cash for my college degree. But if I hadn't, if I had student loans to pay off, I would have been in a really bad place because I have still, 20 years later, or rather 18 to be exact, not had a full-time job. I have not yet been paid what I firmly believe I am worth because every time I take a job, I am stifled in one way or another from excelling at that job. And I don't know all the answers. I know that God has provided for me everything that I need, so I'm not here to complain. All I'm saying is that if I had a college loan, it would be that much more difficult for me to be able to thrive and to have some savings and to be able to be living a good life despite being below where I wish to be financially. And so we need to make sure that we have realistic expectations for our young people. And that means we need to stop giving out huge loans to people that either are not going to finish college or people that are not intended to go to college or people that will never get jobs that will allow them to pay off their college loans. The reality is, in the economy that we have today, there are so many jobs that you can do without a college education. And what we need is more employers to realize that a diligent employee that's willing to learn is worth more than someone with a four-year degree or even a four-year degree and a graduate degree who thinks they know it all and isn't willing to learn. We need to take a much more realistic approach to education. And part of the problem that we have in education also is that the only thing that tends to happen at mainstream universities today is for liberal professors to totally change and reframe children's worldview to become what they want, to become what will work for the state, so to speak, and not someone who would give fresh new ideas to the society in which they live. We need to make sure that our basis for education is the Bible, because the Bible is a definitive moral standard. The Bible says, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." And I really believe that if we school our children in the Bible and how important it is, they will become great employees just because of that. Now, is it unrealistic to have some sort of educational opportunity? No, it is not. There are certainly some jobs, particularly doctor and lawyer and the like, where a college education is a must. But let's not just send our kids to college because it's the societal expectation. Let's instead figure out what they want to do and give them the best path forward to that job. I know plenty of people who have been successful in life without advanced degrees. And Adam McNutt, who was on my podcast, had a long broadcasting career without ever going to college. So it is possible, given the right opportunities, that you can excel without spending a lot of money on a college education. The bottom line is to approach all of life as a learning opportunity, to seek as many opportunities to hone your skills as you can, and to pledge, by God's grace, to become a better person each and every day, and to esteem others better than yourself. If you do those things, you'll be an ideal employee for a lot of different people. My final story today deals with the ongoing discussion about reparations for Black Americans.
All right, put your coffee down because I don't want you to spit it out. The reparations debate, and these numbers are big. At least 21 cities and counties across America are considering a reparations program. Evanston, Illinois already has established one. It's costing taxpayers $10 million. Now, one Texas Democrat is taking it a step farther. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is suggesting that all black people should be exempt from paying all taxes as a form of reparations. Here it is.
One of the things that they propose is black folk not have to pay taxes for a certain amount of time, because then again, that puts money back in your pocket. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, we argue the reparations make sense, because so many black folk, not only do you owe for the labor that was stolen and killed and all the other things. And so it's like, if you do the no tax thing, for people that are already, say, struggling and aren't really paying taxes in the first place, it doesn't really exactly.
All right, we've just been jazz-splained.
Well, the economic debate about reparations has been going on for quite a while now. It started out in California. Now it's more national. Right. I will tell you, I was looking at two different studies from two different professors, one at Duke, one at Harvard. The estimated range of what it would cost on a national basis to pay reparations is anywhere from $10 to $19 trillion.
Wait a minute. How much is our debt?
We are sitting on $28 trillion as a nation in debt right now.
More than half of
money
the debt?
Money to Ukraine. Yes, that's what the overall cost would be if some of these discussions and proposals came to fruition. Look, slavery was America's original sin. I agree with Mitch McConnell on that. But we can't afford this right now. There are other ways that we could find, if we so do choose so as a nation, to give out reparations, but this is not the way. Financial payments is not the way, and more tax issues. And Marie, it's not the
way. Yeah, excuse me. So I think that when we look, for example, at Evanston's program, it was very, very narrowly tailored to help with housing inequality, right? So it did things like tax credits and some payments to help address long-term segregation in housing. That's a very narrowly tailored reparations bill. And they did studies.
What about poor white people?
And voters,
what do they get?
And voters supported that. But voters overwhelmingly supported it. I think what I would actually prefer to reparations is to fix some of our longstanding problems that still exist in how we do federal government programs that are unequal, not just with race, but with class and with economy, a whole number of things. But some of these programs are tailored narrowly and I think can be beneficial to communities.
Do you think black people shouldn't pay taxes?
I think everyone should pay taxes.
Okay. A high tide rises all boats. No, a high tide raises all boats. That's the point. That's what Donald Trump figured out, and that's how he lowered black unemployment to the lowest it's been in 50 years.
I just don't think black people need blue-haired liberals to rescue us. Mm. I think we're hardworking people. You know, a lot of us didn't have it easy. But a lot of us are willing to do the work every single day.
And we can.
And we've been doing the work. The number one small businesses in the country is black women. Mm. And so I think what would behoove, as Emily May said, the liberals to do is to remove some of the barriers that are blocking the progress of black Americans. They prefer the teachers union when it comes to education. They prefer more regulation when it comes to our businesses. So imagine your ancestors going through slavery, you finally get something, you get a business, start putting money back in the community, and then the government wants to take 60% of that.
So, where do I begin? First of all, I want to start out by talking about the obvious, and that is that the government is really good at coming up with programs and ideas and things to spend money on. But they never tell us directly where the money is going to come from. It would be nice in a quote unquote perfect world to just have something that you want to start and to be able to throw money at it and make it happen. But the reality is that we are so far in debt as a country that we need to find ways to save money, not keep spending money. But perhaps more importantly, has anyone alive today ever been a slave owner or been a slave? The answer is no. And I remember several weeks ago, I brought up a story where San Francisco, as a city, was contemplating a reparations program, and it turned out that someone studied history and showed that there was never any slavery that took place in San Francisco. So they were developing a reparations program for a place where slavery wasn't even an issue. The other factor of this is even if you could somehow trace people's ancestry to the point of being able to tell when someone was a slave or not, or maybe when someone had an ancestor that was a master or not, it's still pretty convoluted. As Brian Baumgartner says, I'm half black and half white. So is the black part of me supposed to get paid by the white part of me? I think that many people would be surprised if they did their DNA, how much different history is in that report. We are a melting pot of people, but we are also a melting pot when it comes to races within our family. We all have different percentages of different races within the family, and I think the key thing to remember is that we are all made in the image of God. We are made male and female, and those are the only distinctions that God says are important in the scriptures. Yes, he chose the people of Israel to be his people, but he even says to the children of Israel, I did not choose you to be my people because you are mighty or because you are greater than other people. I chose you to be my people because I have chosen to love you. It didn't mean that he didn't love other people. As a matter of fact, all through the scriptures, you find Gentile people that join the people of Israel or join in the New Testament, the Church of God, because it was always intended one way or another for us all to be accepted. There is a verse that talks about the Jews being a light to the Gentiles, but then the Jews chose not to be a light to the Gentiles. It is said of Jesus that he came unto his own and his own received him not, but to as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. And of course that includes daughters because it includes everyone. But the reality is that we as humans are the ones that do the dividing, not the Lord Jesus. He says to us, you are one. He says to us, I've broken down the middle wall of partition. Did we make mistakes in our past as a nation? Yes. But as Candace Owens famously says, it is the very constitution that we have that guides the laws of our land that allowed us to get out from under the national stain of slavery. It is that very device that so many people seem to hate that allowed us to do away with slavery. We have a constitutional amendment that tells African Americans and all other people that to be a human living in the United States gives you equal rights if you are a citizen. And so there is no divide now. So any divide that is put forth by a lobby that wants to keep people divided. That, I think, is the reality on so many issues. That there are people in our government that say, if we legitimately help these people, they will not need us anymore. So we need to give lip service to helping them, but we actually need to keep them down. We've come to a place in our culture where we're asking for reparations, but we've also come to a place in our culture where we essentially pay women to be in broken homes. We encourage people that they don't need to have a two-parent family to survive, because we actually reward people for not being in two-parent homes. And then we wonder why there is chaos among us. We need to get back to the blueprint of Scripture. And that blueprint says that God made Adam and Eve. He put them together for a lifetime. He commanded men and women to leave their father and mother, specifically men as the leaders in the household, to leave father and mother, to cleave unto his wife, and those two to be one flesh. That is the key to so much success in society. That's the key to good neighborhoods. That's the key to good cities. That's the key to good states. That's the key to our nation. It's an economic key because people that are happily married have better economic prospects. And it's the key to your children having the stability to become good contributors to the economy. And so there's so much tied into that. So if I could encourage you in one thing today, it's to prioritize loving your family. That is the most important thing, aside from loving Jesus, that you can possibly do to make your society better, is to love your family and to train them up in the ways of the Lord. Because when your children leave home and they have a foundation in the Lord, they can make a huge impact in society. In Psalm 127, it says that children are like arrows in the hands of a mighty man. Arrows need to be shot. And when an arrow is shot straight, it can hit the target and make a big difference. So that is my encouragement for you, is that you, as a parent, will shoot straight arrows, and that the society will be better for it. That's about all I have time to share for today's episode of Culture Watch. If you have been benefited by this episode and encouraged, please drop me a line and share with me how it has impacted you. You can also share with me any questions or concerns or any stories that you think I should discuss on a future episode. I would love to hear from you either way. And also, please continue to share this podcast with family and friends. That's how more people find out what I am doing here at Speaking for Him. With that being said, I will simply say, have a great week and keep serving the best of masters.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Your host has been Andrew Gomeson, founder of Speaking for Him. For more information on today's show and to leave us comments and voicemails, visit speakingforhim.blogspot.com. You can find Andrew's ministry at speakingforhim.com. That's speaking, the number 4, H-I-M. You can also interact with us at facebook.com/speakingforhim and on Twitter at Speaking for Him. And when you look for us on iTunes and Stitcher, let us know what you think of the podcast by leaving a rating and review.